You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out why athletes and the press often have a difficult relationship and how to make post-game interviews more interesting. Now, the University of Wisconsin system says it's seen a rise in applications to campuses around the state. This week, it reported a 30% bump in freshman applications across the system over the last couple of years. Whether those translate into admissions and higher enrollment for state schools has yet to be seen, but Interim System President Tommy Thompson said he's optimistic about what it means for the fall semester. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or someone in your family applied to college in the last year in Wisconsin or elsewhere? What issues have you weighed in making that decision? Did the pandemic make you reconsider where you went to college and when you went to college? Call it at 800-642-1234. If you work in higher education, maybe in admissions, what are you seeing? 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@WPR.org. Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. Rich, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
All right, this jump in applications, 30% system-wide, bigger at some campuses than others, I imagine. Can you break down what we're seeing across the state, Rich?
Sure. The biggest increase happened at UW-Green Bay. So we're talking year over year, June of 2020 versus June of 2021. They saw a 72% increase in applications. UW-Eau Claire was at 50% increase in that same time frame. Platteville saw a 41% increase, and it kind of goes down from there. Some of the smallest increases are at UW-Parkside and UW-Madison, but I was told by a former governor and current system interim president, Tommy Thompson, that they've got a waiting list, so it's kind of a different story for them.
How much of this is rebound? Because I know the concern last year, pandemic year, was that a lot of these campuses were seeing a big decline in enrollment.
Yeah, it's a big question, and I don't have the answer for you, Rob. In terms of rebound, I mean, it's a good sign is what I'm hearing from UW people, particularly interim president Tommy Thompson. We just saw kind of a period where people didn't seem to know if it made sense to enroll, mm-hmm. you know, with online classes. There were some surveys in the very outset of the pandemic when things got serious and the lockdowns happened that indicated a lot of high school seniors were thinking about taking a semester at least off. And that was a big, big problem potentially for higher education, especially in Wisconsin, because, you know, the enrollment numbers have gone down since they hit real records and peaks in around the 2010 time. So they were already dealing with enrollment declines, and then the pandemic, there was a lot of concern that it could really be a problem. But the applications being up seems to be a good sign.
What kind of things does the UW system do to change things to encourage people to maybe make it easier to apply after those declines?
Yeah, over the past 15 months, I guess the UW system, they waived application fees. So I think it's around $50 to apply at a UW campus. Not every campus waived application fees. I was told that UW-Eau Claire, UW-La Crosse, and UW-Madison still have them. But Thompson told me that all campuses were encouraged to, but they had the ultimate, you know, final decision in whether to waive that fee. $50, you know, can really add up if you're applying to two or three different UW campuses. And the students can also now apply online, and one application gets them, they're able to apply to as many UW campuses as they want with a single application. I've been told by provost at UW-Green Bay that it seems like students are kind of going for around three or four maybe, and it's all over the place. People are selecting different institutions based on their interests, you know, majors, et cetera, but also some are, you know, geographically bound. They want to stay in this particular area. The other big thing that seems to be contributing to this was a change that was totally due to the pandemic, but UW campuses waived the requirement that students provide ACT scores during the application process. Whether that's going to stick around is unknown. It was kind of part of a trend nationwide that some campuses, some universities in other states were getting rid of, they're going test optional or test, you know, test free basically. And, you know, some of the proponents of that move say that ACT scores, you know, it's just another hurdle for students that might do well in college, have to get past, because especially during the pandemic, it was not easy to take these, you still had to take these tests in a room, you know, and it was difficult. And the argument is that especially underserved students from lower income families, they just don't have the same kind of opportunities to get tutored for ACT or SAT tests. So it's an equity thing.
Talking to Rich Kramer, WPR News reporter, looking at a jump in applications to the UW system after a down year during the pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has the pandemic changed the way you or your family considered higher education, whether to apply, when to apply, where to go? If you're looking at this from the other side of things in higher education, what are you seeing coming across your desks this year? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Rich, these are applications. When you talk to these administrators across the system, when are they going to know if more applications translates into more enrollments, more students on campus come fall?
Yeah, the big judgment day, I guess, will be it's 10 days into the fall semester, which is at most campuses, the semester starts right at the beginning of September. So 10 days in, they'll have the data. It takes them a while to kind of clean it up and then report that to the main system office, and it takes a while for it to make it to, it's usually reported during a UW Regents meeting, but those numbers usually don't come out until around October, November, that kind of time frame. But I'm going to be very interested to see what those numbers are. I was told that you know, there's a lot of variables to these applications. A lot of times universities will tout applications, but it doesn't translate, you know, into direct, you know, it's not a one-to-one translation. So I've been told that it's around 40%. That was from the UW Green Bay interim provost. Kate Burns said that traditionally they see about 40% of applicants actually enroll, but there's just, so it's just not a normal time right now. So those traditional kind of measures go out the window a bit.
I want to key in on something in your reporting, Rich, that struck me when you're talking with Tommy Thompson. He was optimistic, not just about the increase in numbers, but some of the demographics of who, some of the categories of people who were applying. What had him excited?
Yeah, he was, you know, the overall number, of course, it has him optimistic, but he was also very, very proud that the number of underrepresented students, you know, Black, Latino, and other minority groups are up. First generation college student applications are up. I guess they're not students yet, but that's the idea. So these are groups that the UW system and really a lot of higher education everywhere has been talking about, because there's all these kind of projections that show the traditional, you know, high school graduate going straight into college, that age group is just getting smaller in Wisconsin because of just lower birth rates over the past, you know, 20 years. And that doesn't seem to be changing. So they keep talking, or there was discussions a few years ago about a demographic cliff. It appears that around 2026 and beyond, that the average number of what are known as traditional college age students will be, declining. So they've been trying to find, you know, working adults that might have some credit but not a degree. How do we get them in, you know, and how do we get them that credential that they want? They're trying to reach out to improve diversity on campus. It's been an ongoing effort, and some say it hasn't gone fast enough, but it's increased. I looked at some data, and the number of underrepresented students is up. I think it's around the 15% of the total UW student body, if you will. But that's still it's an improvement. Some would like to see it go faster and further.
We'll leave it there. Rich, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
That's Rich Kramer, WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. He talked with us about a rise in applications to UW system colleges over the last year. In a minute, we'll find out whether that trend holds up on the national level, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you one of these people driving up these application numbers in the UW system or elsewhere? You or someone in your family, if you work in education or admissions, what are you seeing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about college applications heading into the fall semester. UW System reports an increase in applications. Now we're looking at trends around the country. You can join in if you have questions or experiences to share at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Scott Jasek is editor of Inside Higher Ed. Scott, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
I want to see how these UW system numbers fit in with what's going on nationally. Let's start with public institutions like the UW. What kind of things are we seeing around the country there?
Sure. So the flagships are doing very well, but that would just be UW-Madison. They are getting a lot of students. They had a lot of applicants. Students say they'll travel there as well. Nationally, the regionals, state universities, are not doing as well. So that's why the Wisconsin numbers really stand out.
I want to bring on a caller who wants to expand the conversation at 800-642-1234. Alyssa is with us in Sparta. Alyssa, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm hoping that the speaker can talk about the predictions for technical schools and private universities within the state. Thank you.
Alyssa, thanks. Great question, Scott. What are we seeing for the technical colleges on the one hand and private campuses?
The technical and community colleges are really hurting nationally. They are struggling for students, not because they're not a good place to go. They are good and they are inexpensive. But many of those students were particularly hard hit during the pandemic, and they're struggling to get back. Private colleges, it depends how prestigious you are. Harvard's doing great. They're having a record year. Most non-famous private colleges are struggling a bit, but one exception I wrote about a few weeks ago is St. Norbert College up in Green Bay. They're having a record year. So it really depends on what you're doing.
Thanks a lot for that call. Great question, Alyssa. Scott, you wrote recently that a lot of those private colleges in particular are extending their admissions period, their admissions season. How are they trying to deal with, not having those admissions locked in yet?
So for private colleges, May 1st is the deadline to reply to an offer. Most private colleges have extended those deadlines, some to June 1st, some to July 1st. Many will basically take you until they start in the fall.
Let's bring on another caller at 800-642-1234 with Joyce in Platteville. Joyce, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Joyce?
I just wanted to say my son applied this year to the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I've always wanted to have a kid go to school here. We lived in Dubuque for 8 years. But he's accepted at Iowa already, but waitlisted at Wisconsin. And Wisconsin was supposed to be a target school for him. I was going to say that it wound up hurting him that the university system did not look at test scores so well. Hmm. He transferred to two different schools. He's been at an international school in Bogota, Colombia. And if they would have looked more at test scores, I think I would have assumed that he would have been in their first round. But now that they've waited so long, I don't think he'll be changing at this point.
Uh-oh. Joyce, thanks a lot for that call. You hear that, UW-Madison? Can't let Joyce's kid escape to Iowa. But Joyce raises a really interesting point, Scott. The impact of all those schools, and we heard this from Rich too, all these schools saying test optional or we don't care about your test scores at all. We're going to be figuring out how this shakes out for a long time, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, this year is a really crazy year in that respect, because most colleges are not requiring or not looking at test scores. It's possible your son would have gotten in, but the colleges are reporting they are admitting more minority students, more low-income students, who historically don't do as well on the tests. Now, your son is going to be fine at the University of Iowa. Sorry to say that into a Wisconsin audience. But, the reality is the students who don't get in because of this are generally going to be fine. The students who they're getting in for the first time, many times they were overlooked in the past.
Thanks a lot for that call, Joyce, at 800-642-1234. Scott, we heard from a Rich Kramer, a reporter, about the demographic cliff that a lot of colleges, especially in areas where you don't see rising populations, they're saying, hey, we're just like by raw numbers, we're not going to have a big potential pool of college candidates. How big a problem is this around the country?
It's a very big problem in the Midwest and the Northeast. You know the issue. If your state is losing people, or if parts of your state are losing people, it really matters, because most public colleges and also most private colleges enroll students who live near them, and so that population is shrinking, and that is a very serious issue in Wisconsin. Leaving aside Madison.
We're talking to Scott Jasek, editor of Inside Higher Ed, looking at college admissions numbers this year. We heard from Rich Kramer. UW system applications, anyway, jumped up a lot, rebounded a lot after last year. We're looking at what's going on around the country. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Jane is with us in Manitowoc. Jane, hello.
Hello. I'm just wondering how much the COVID insecurity of customer service type jobs and stuff that affected the enrollment as far as the technical jobs where people can work from home and things like that might have impacted this.
Interesting, Jane. Thanks a lot for that call. So, Scott, we've talked about the ever-running debate of how much is a college degree worth. Jane's saying, hey, maybe having those college degree type jobs where you could work remotely during the pandemic tipped the scales in people's minds. What do you think?
Well, it's interesting. What is going on this year, maybe not in Wisconsin, really counters the national trend, which over tons of years, when the economy is bad, college enrollment goes up in technical schools, in schools that serve those students. This year, that didn't happen. When the economy tanked and a lot of people lost their jobs, enrollment went down at community colleges. A lot of people were worried. I don't know what it's going to be in the long run. I think we'll have to see.
Jane, thanks a lot for that call. And it seems like, Scott, from your reporting on this, there is a lot of uncertainty, not just with how many students are applying, but how many are going to accept and show up on a particular campus. I imagine a lot of college administrators are on pins and needles wondering how it's going to shake out come mid-September.
Yeah, I mean, the colleges rely on complex formulas that will say, you know, if you admit X number of students, Y will show up. This year, they're really going on their own because those formulas probably won't work this year. It's really going to be anyone's guess what happens in September.
What are colleges going to look like this fall? We're coming out of a year where, you know, some schools went all virtual, some hybrid, some brought students in, but tried to be careful about it. From what you're hearing and seeing, Scott, what are we looking at in September?
We're probably looking at most colleges returning to semi-normal. They are going to let students, be on campus, hoping for the best. Now, if you are a large campus, there may be some controls on particularly large classrooms, but people want it to be normal. And that's what they're going for now. I worry about what that will mean in states that are not vaccinated.
One thing I haven't brought up, Scott, is often a part of the process for that prospective student and their family is the campus visit. And in-person visits were just off the table, it seemed like. How much did that shake things up?
It shook things up a lot. A lot of students, like you said, want to see the campus. Now, St. Norbert, which I said is doing very well, one of the reasons they think they're doing well is that they opened the campus up for visits early in the process. And that gave them an edge over other campuses that were closed.
Have you seen colleges change the way they market themselves? As the parent of two just graduated high school seniors, I could like insulate my house with all the brochures and stuff I got from campuses. Did colleges end up being more aggressive this last year?
Oh, yeah. I mean, colleges had to do anything to get students. Most colleges had to do anything. They're sending out more materials. They're, you know, because students couldn't go to campus, they're creating online experiences for students to feel on campus. And so it's just a matter of a college is going to do anything possible to reach a potential student.
In our last minute or so, Scott, what's one of the big open questions you're watching for over the next few months?
So the big open question for me is in states that are not vaccinating at the proper amount, what will it be like in the fall? Most of those states are against limits on who can enroll, against requirements. In Arizona, the governor banned requiring a test, requiring a COVID vaccine, and requiring a face mask for those who didn't get a vaccine. That is potentially a recipe for a problem.
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you.
Scott Jasek is editor of Inside Higher Ed. He talked with us today about the application trends that colleges around the country are seeing as they approach the fall semester. Earlier, we talked to WPR reporter Rich Kramer about a big jump in applications to the UW system. Coming up, post-game interviews. After sporting events are famously not always great. Our guest says we can make them better and have more interesting sports journalism along the way. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, two doctors explain how patients with sickle cell anemia, most of whom in the U.S. are Black, face racism within the healthcare system that puts their lives at risk. First, Japanese tennis star Naomi Osaka made headlines earlier this month when she skipped a press conference during the French Open. Osaka said press conferences exacerbated her mental health struggles and then withdrew from the tournament. There's a history of athletes expressing frustration with the press. Sometimes they just find requirements to talk to the media annoying. Take Seattle Seahawks running back Marshawn Lynch back in the day. We'll let him speak for himself.
Hey, I'm just here so I don't get fined. So y'all can sit here and ask me all the questions y'all want to. I'm going to answer with the same answer so y'all can shoot if y'all please. I'm here so I won't get fined.
We're talking about the sometimes contentious relationship between pro athletes and the journalists who cover them, with a sports journalist who says her profession could do better. Nicole Kraft is an associate professor of clinical communication and director of the Sports and Society Initiative at The Ohio State University. She's author of the book Always Get the Name of the Dog, A Guide to Media Interviewing. Nicole, welcome to Central Time.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you.
Well, as we heard there from Marshawn Lynch, athletes not always keen to talk to the media. And you wrote in a recent piece on The Conversation, you don't necessarily blame those athletes. What do you want to see better from those sports interviewers?
You know, I think we have many challenges that confront us with the environment of a press conference. There used to be a much more intimate relationship between the media and sports personalities. A lot of one-on-one time, you were able to kind of build up a rapport with someone before you were going to ask them difficult questions after a significant loss or, you know, a challenging performance. And now with the way that media is structured, the quantity of media that teams are dealing with, the press conference has become a primary pathway for people to get the information that they need, which means there is no relationship built. There's just kind of this feeling that athletes are in a lot of ways being attacked, that they are being asked questions that have little context for them, or the massaging that might come from a more personal relationship. So I think what we're faced with are, you know, athletes that don't fully appreciate what media are trying to do in terms of getting information for the public. And we're faced with media who are under incredible time constraints because of the 24-hour news cycle. Many of them are not necessarily trained or coming up through what we would consider to be mainstream journalistic channels that would maybe prepare them to ask questions that are more insightful or elicit a more reasonable response or a response that was more useful to them. And so I think it's caused a great deal of friction between interviewer and interviewee.
There's this weird symbiotic relationship, right? I mean, pro sports get tons and tons of free publicity from the media. The media makes a lot of money by talking about sports. I don't. Why can't we have a more productive, interesting relationship when you bring the two of them together in that conference room?
There's not a great deal of incentive in some ways. Media used to be the only pathway for athletes and teams to communicate with their fan base. Now, of course, many teams have their own in-house media and trained journalists that work for the teams themselves. You have a multitude of platforms where athletes' social media being the most obvious, that athletes can communicate with their own fans. So, you know, what you're faced with is a growing media enterprise where you have, you know, bloggers and podcasters and people who are being credentialed that fill a media room that don't necessarily have the background or the experience or the training to be asking questions that are really insightful or elicit an insightful response. We get a lot of, yes or no questions, so closed-ended questions that don't enable someone to really provide good context. We also get the talk about question, which is, you know, requiring the source to do all the work and not necessarily requiring the interviewer to have any great deal of background when they ask the question. So that combination of factors, I think, has caused a lot of animus between athletes and the media that cover them. And I think athletes are seeing, you know, how is this benefiting me? It's not like I need this pathway in order to have people pay attention to what I do. And if I'm going to feel put upon or feel like I'm not being treated with the level of respect that I deserve, why do I need to do this at all?
Let's bring out a caller now. We've got Charlie with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Growing up, I can remember that there were sports writers who were a little more literary than we see today, guys like Frank DeFord, Plimpton, or even Bud Lee here in at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And I was just wondering if you think that part of the decline in the sports interview is due to the fact that the people conducting the interview, the journalists, don't have the literary chops that old-time people did, such that a contentious question is easier to write about than maybe a more insightful question.
Interesting, Charlie. What do you think, Nicole?
I totally see your point. You know, I'm a huge fan of John Hervey, a huge fan of Frank DeFord. And I think, you know, people read long-form material then. So there was a lot of opportunity to ask questions in what we would consider to be the bell curve, which I actually talk about in my book, where you build up to questions that you build a rapport, and then you get your questions, and you don't really start to hit your peak of maybe some controversial questions till you're maybe, you know, two-thirds of the way over the bell curve. And what that allowed was relationship building. You allowed people to have a level of trust with the reporter that they were working with. You allowed deeper insights, the ability for a sports personality to say, you know, let me tell you this, and then we'll figure out the best way for it to be published. We don't necessarily have that relationship building. And I agree with you that we're not developing writers to craft stories anymore. And a lot of that has to do with the need to get things out on social right away, the need to put things up on websites, you know, within seconds of them happening. We're not cultivating even a week's worth of content as we did when Sports Illustrated was in its heyday. So that does not allow for, you know, real discerning writing and in-depth reporting that would normally generate stories that you're describing from the authors that you're describing. So there's still many qualified writers out there and many, you know, I work with many, many talented writers and good friends of mine at The Athletic who do get some long form opportunity. But when you're on that daily grind and you're trying to, you know, either fill a news hole or fill web space or put stuff out on social, there's just a kind of a surgical strike to it that doesn't allow for the nuanced reporting that we used to see.
Thanks for that call, Charlie. Nicole, one thing that wasn't there in the old days is a lot of channels where players can go directly to the public themselves, social media, the Players Tribune, where players write things. That there's been some really interesting stuff there. How much does that that change things and maybe make those reporters and those press conferences less relevant?
Oh, I think it's changed things dramatically. I mean, if I never used to have, you know, as a fan, I never had access to what players were thinking or feeling, their experiences. And I think the channels that you just described, you know, the Players Tribune is a terrific resource and very well, you know, it's beautifully written. And we get some amazing stories out of that we're not going to entrust to reporters to a great degree. And the same thing with social. I mean, even you mentioned Naomi Osaka in the introduction, when she mentioned and said that she was not going to be doing press conferences, she didn't release that through the media. She didn't release it through the tournament. She released that herself on her Twitter account. So, you know, being able to communicate directly with the fans and shape your own message has allowed sports personalities to say that this relationship with the media is not one that they need to cultivate.
Nicole, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
That's Nicole Kraft from The Ohio State University, author of the book Always Get the Name of the Dog, A Guide to Media Interviewing. Probably have to have her back to talk about that. I could learn a thing or two. She joined us today, though, to look at ways to make post-game sports interviews more interesting. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Sauk County dairy farm.
Facing Wisconsin's family farms may have slipped from the headlines, but it hasn't stopped. Many are losing everything. Others are evolving and trying to make it. Wisconsin writer Brian Reisinger shares the struggle of one farm family, his own.
Most people will never see a farm like ours. But you don't just see it, you smell it and hear it. Like our cows coming into the barn for milking. It's one of those moments that sinks deep into your mind, then your blood and your bones, until it's there for good. At least, that's how our family feels, and also what we hope. Because after 100 years of Reisinger's dairy farming in Sauk County, we sold our cows and are looking for life after milking. Life not only for us, but our farm too.
Well, this is our dairy farm.
My dad, Jim, started milking when he was 8.
My dad fell off of a corn crib out here. That's when I kind of got interested in farming because, well, my dad needed help.
Stories like that make it seem like family farms can stand forever, even against a changing economy that long ago left us behind.
Be honest with you, I hate to see them go. You know, I've been milking here all my life, born and raised here.
My dad and sister, Malia, have farmed together for almost 2 decades. My mom and I took our turns, too. But whenever I join Malia in our small 50-cow milk barn, I remember she's cut out for this in a way I'm not. When it dropped below zero this winter, she was 7 months pregnant and still milking.
Dairy cows are like working moms. So they go to work, they have to pump, where a beef cow is more like a stay-at-home mom that just takes care of her kid.
Milking got my great-grandparents through the Depression. My sister's kids mark 5 generations on this land. But things are different now. We planned our transition for more than a year, struggling over how to survive as other farms got bigger or disappeared. A farm is more than your job. It's your community and heritage. It's a way of life. But dairying is too hard financially and physically with my parents getting older. After years of breaking even, we needed a way to keep our farm in the family and fund their retirement. There's no 401k for farmers. We all have wondered if things could have been different. What if the economics were more in our favor? What could each of us have done differently a decade or more ago? I'll always ask, what if I'd been a farmer instead of a writer? My dad would have held on forever if COVID hadn't put him in the hospital. It literally took a global pandemic to stop him.
The stress is morning and night. Gotta be there. Being 69 and a half years old, that COVID that really hit me hard, I know I can't do it anymore.
We could have gone in debt to go bigger, but our family takes pride in being shoulder to shoulder with our animals.
Come on in.
Come on, baby.
Come
on, baby.
Come on.
So we're trying a new business model, raising heifers for other farms and cash cropping corn, hay, and soybeans. We're grateful to keep our 400 acres. But it still feels like something was taken from us. A few weeks before the cows went, we got together to milk. My mom, Jean, remember being in the barn as newlyweds.
We would listen to the Grand Ole Opry, and when they would have the dances come on, we'd dance. It slows it down, but it makes us so much happier, and happy farmers make happy cows.
In March, big trailers rolled up to haul our cows away. The cows kept turning back, like they didn't want to go. Afterward, my dad roamed the farm, ending near the barn door where the cows come in. now only in our memory. The cow's last day, they gave more milk than ever before.
We went out with a bang. The cow's milk strong this morning. I mean strong.
He felt like they did it for him.
I think they made me new.
Brian Reisinger is a writer based in Madison who grew up on that dairy farm in Sauk County. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowland Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, two doctors specializing in sickle cell anemia share how structural racism in healthcare can impact the roughly 100,000 Americans who suffer from the disease. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A new study found that a screening known to improve long-term outcomes in kids with sickle cell anemia is not consistently or routinely given. That screening, invented in 1982, prevents life-threatening strokes in children with the blood disease. It's recommended by the National Institutes of Health. Some experts say this failure to provide care is just one example of the many ways in which patients with sickle cell disease, who in this country are mostly black, suffer because of systemic racism present in the American healthcare system. Our next guests are the co-authors of the article, When Actions Speak Louder Than Words, Racism and Sickle Cell Disease, published in the New England Journal of Medicine last year. Dr. Alexandra Power-Hayes is a clinical fellow at the Cancer and Blood Disease Institute at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. Dr. Power-Hayes, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And Dr. Patrick McGann is an academic pediatric hematologist at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. Dr. McGann, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Dr. McGann, in this piece, you wrote that sickle cell patients may be the demographic that's the single most affected by systemic racism in healthcare. Can you expand on that a little for us?
Sure. So the sickle cell disease is a genetic condition that arose to protect people against malaria, people who have sickle cell trait. This happened primarily in Africa. And as a result of the transcontinental slave trade many years ago, most Americans are black with sickle cell disease. Really the only condition in this country where most patients are black or African American. And many efforts, especially over the last year, to address racism in medicine have begun to make strides. But sickle cell disease is one condition where we're lagging behind and really need concentrated efforts.
Dr. Power-Hayes, can you tell us how that might affect the life of someone with sickle cell disease? Where are they not going to get treatment that somebody with maybe a different condition who's white might have gotten it?
Yeah, so as we state in the article, someone's genetic or someone's family ancestry or where the mutation arose should really be a source of medical history and trivia and really should not impact their current care. But as we know, in the United States, race affects a lot. And so when you have a population of patients with one disease that do primarily affect Black people, and you also have a healthcare system that has issues with racism, just as many of the institutions in the United States do, then those two things overlap and create problems for that patient population that need to be addressed.
Dr. McGann, how much overlap is there in this country between someone who might have sickle cell disease and other strikes against them when it comes to health, whether that's neighborhood environment, poverty, access to health care?
Yeah, it's a great question. So Dr. Power-Hayes is an expert in what we call social determinants of health, which are the things that you mentioned, access to food and housing and education and all of these things that are basic rights of humanity that many of our patients struggle with because of being Black in this country. And so these patients not only are faced with a chronic, devastating condition, but they also have to navigate this in the healthcare system while also suffering from these social determinants of health.
Dr. Power-Hayes, what would you like to see from the medical community, first of all, just in how they treat patients with sickle cell? What kind of changes could be made maybe quickly and easily?
Absolutely. I think that I will start by saying everyone who goes into healthcare does it because they want to help patients. But humans, including doctors and nurses, are fallible and have racial biases, just as do people in other professions. And so I think it's actually really important for doctors and nurses and those in the healthcare system to not feel like they are immune or that they are better than those in other fields, and to actually recognize the racial biases that they hold. And I think that's the first step, and not an easy step, but an important step towards making changes. Because if you don't realize that you are contributing to a problem because you don't recognize it in yourself, then the problem persists. And that really trickles down into many aspects of care for Black patients, care for patients with sickle cell disease, or really care for many minorities of all types.
Talking to Dr. Alexandra Power-Hayes and Dr. Patrick McGann, they wrote a piece on sickle cell disease in the United States and racial inequality, structural racism, how that is keeping people in some cases from getting care they need for sickle cell. Dr. McGann, sickle cell, it's a genetic condition, obviously, therefore a chronic condition that people are going to be dealing with all their lives. But I've seen both in your piece and elsewhere concerns that it isn't always treated that way. Like if you had a diabetes treatment, you'd have these regular checkups with them. Are we where we need to be on treating sickle cell as a chronic disease?
No, we're absolutely not, for a lot of the reasons that we've talked about. You mentioned at the top of this piece a screening test for stroke, that if you do this screening test every year for children starting at a young age and institute treatments when needed, stroke shouldn't happen to children, and it still does. There's a medicine that's been around for 30 years called hydroxyurea that is an essential medicine for sickle cell disease. It reduces many of the complications, that's used in less than half of children and only a fraction of adults with sickle cell disease. Again, a condition where you have a good medicine that's really only used in a small number of patients is a problem.
Dr. Power-Hayes, can you talk about the research side of things? How has sickle cell stacked up when it comes to funding priorities?
Yes, great question. So while we like to look at science as separate from politics, I think that what this last year has shown is that in sometimes, in some ways, politics dictates a lot about scientific discovery, and where we choose to put our money really affects the discoveries that we are making and the speed at which we make those discoveries. And so for a long time, even though many patients with sickle cell disease have a known common mutation in the majority of types of sickle cell disease in the United States. So we know the underlying mutation, but it wasn't a funding priority. And scientists and doctors who are researchers in the lab need to keep the lights on. And if you can't convince the governmental agencies who fund research to help you keep the lights on and contribute to your research, it's really hard to get things off the ground. And so fortunately, in like the last probably decade, there has been realization of the importance of sickle cell disease as a research priority, and there's been increased funding. And with that, in the last few years, there has been a dramatic increase in the number of FDA-approved medications for sickle cell disease. But as Dr. McGann just mentioned, there's one great drug that for decades was the only medication for sickle cell disease. And this is in stark contrast to other genetic disorders that have had, that have many options for treatment. And some of those disorders are far more rare than sickle cell disease, but still have had faster pace of their research.
We'll leave it there. Dr. Power-Hayes, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
And Dr. McGann, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Alexandra Power-Hayes is a clinical fellow at the Cancer and Blood Disease Institute at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. Dr. Patrick McGann is an academic pediatric hematologist at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. They wrote about sickle cell disease in the New England Journal of Medicine and the impact of structural racism in American healthcare. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. tomorrow at 7. Eviction bans have kept people in their homes for a while. They are expiring in most places. Find out about the legal issues surrounding evictions and the process and what options people have when they get that eviction notice. That's tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show. Coming up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then some cities around the country are dealing with an uptick in violent crime and homicides. We'll hear how President Biden plans to address the issue. That's part of our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.